last month? It wasn't, but in any case, the Baron hasn't honored me with a visit in nearly 3 months. No wonder I'm feeling so exhausted. I'm always saying I ought to spend more time in Kyoto, but, well, one thing leads to another. Let's have another look at that scroll I'm talking about. I can't believe it's been 4 years since I've seen it. Mameha summoned her maid and asked her to bring the scroll from the closet. I was given the job of unrolling it. My hands were trembling so much that it slipped from my grasp when I held it up for the Baron to have a look. "Careful, girl," he said. I was so embarrassed that even after I bowed and apologized, I couldn't help glancing at the Baron again and again to see if he seemed angry with me. While I held the scroll up, he seemed to look at me more than at it, but it wasn't a reproachful stare. After a while, I realized it was curiosity, which only made me feel more self-conscious. "This scroll is much more attractive than the one you have in the alcove now, Mameha," he said. But he still seemed to be looking at me, and made no effort to look away when I glanced at him. "Calligraphy is so old-fashioned, anyway," he went on. "You ought to take that thing in the alcove down and put up this landscape painting again." Mameha had no choice but to do as the Baron suggested. She even managed to look as if she thought it was a fine idea. When the maid and I had finished hanging the painting and rolling up the other scroll, Mameha called me over to pour tea for the Baron. To look at us from above, we formed a little triangle, Mameha, the Baron, and me. But of course, Mameha and the Baron did all the talking. As for me, I did nothing more useful than to kneel there, feeling as much out of my element as a pigeon in a nest of falcons. To think I'd ever imagined myself worthy of entertaining the sorts of men Mameha entertained, not only grand aristocrats like the Baron, but the chairman as well. Even the theater director from several nights earlier, he'd hardly so much as glanced at me. I won't say I'd felt worthy of the Baron's company earlier, but now I couldn't help realizing once again that I was nothing more than an ignorant girl from a fishing village. Hatsumomo, if she had her way, would keep me down so low, every man who visited Gion would forever remain out of my reach. For all I knew, I might never see Baron Matsunaga again, and never come upon the chairman. Wasn't it possible Mameha would realize the hopelessness of my cause and leave me to languish in the Okia like a little worn kimono that had seemed so lovely in the shop? The Baron, who I was beginning to realize was something of a nervous man, leaned over to scratch at a mark on the surface of Mameha's table and made me think of my father on the last day I'd seen him, digging grime out of ruts in the wood with his fingernails. I wonder what he would think if he could see me kneeling here in Mameha's apartment, wearing a robe more expensive than anything he'd ever laid eyes on, with a Baron across from me and one of the most famous geisha in all of Japan at my side. I was hardly worthy of these surroundings, and then I became aware of all the magnificent silk wrapped about my body, and had the feeling I might drown in beauty. At that moment, beauty itself struck me as a kind of painful melancholy. Chapter 16. One afternoon, as Mameha and I were strolling across the Shizuo Avenue Bridge to pick up some new hair ornaments in the Pontocho district, for Mameha never liked the shop selling hair ornaments in Gion, she came to a stop suddenly. An old tugboat was puffing its way beneath the bridge. I thought Mameha was just concerned about the black fumes, but after a moment she turned to me with an expression I couldn't quite understand. "What is it, Mameha-san?" I asked. "I may as well tell you, because you'll hear it from someone else," she said. "Your little friend Pumpkin has just won the Apprentice's Award. It's expected she'll win it a second time as well." Mameha was referring to an award for the apprentice who'd earned the most during the previous month. It may seem strange that such an award existed, but there's a very good reason. Encouraging apprentices to earn as much as possible helps shape them into the sort of geisha who will be most appreciated in Gion, that is to say, the ones who will earn a lot not only for themselves, but for everyone else, too. Several times Mameha had predicted that Pumpkin would struggle along for a few years and end up the sort of geisha with a few loyal customers, none of them wealthy, and little else. It was a sad picture, and I was pleased to learn that Pumpkin was doing better than that. But at the same time, I felt anxiety prickling at my stomach. Pumpkin now seemed to be one of the most popular apprentices in Gion, while I remained one of the most obscure. When I began to wonder what it might mean for my future, the world around me honestly seemed to grow dark. The most astonishing thing about Pumpkin's success, as I stood there on the bridge thinking about it, was that she'd managed to surpass an exquisite young girl named Reha, who'd won the award the past several months. Reha's mother had been a renowned geisha, and her father was a member of one of Japan's most illustrious families, with almost limitless wealth. Whenever Reha strolled past me, I felt as a simple smelt must feel when a silver salmon glides by. How had Pumpkin managed to outdo her? Hatsumomo had certainly pushed her from the very day of her debut, so much that she'd begun to lose weight lately and hardly looked herself. But regardless of how hard Pumpkin may have worked, could she really have grown more popular than Reha? "Oh, now really," said Mameha. "Don't look so sad. You ought to be rejoicing." "Yes, it's very selfish of me," I said. "That isn't what I mean. Hatsumomo and Pumpkin will both pay dearly for this apprentice's award. In 5 years, no one will remember who Pumpkin is." "It seems to me," I said, "that everyone will remember her as the girl who passed Reha." "No one has surpassed Reha. Pumpkin may have earned the most money last month, but Reha is still the most popular apprentice in Gion. Come, I'll explain." Mameha led me to a tea room in the Pontocho district and sat me down. "In Gion," Mameha said, "a very popular geisha can always make sure her younger sister earns more than anyone else if she is willing to risk hurting her own reputation. The reason has to do with the way ohana, flower fees, are billed. In the old days, 100 years or more ago, every time a geisha arrived at a party to entertain, the mistress of the tea house lit a stick of 1 hour incense called one ohana, or flower. The geisha's fees were based on how many sticks of incense had burned by the time she left. The cost of one ohana has always been fixed by the Gion Registry Office. While I was an apprentice, it was 3 yen, which was about the cost of 2 bottles of liquor, perhaps. It may sound like a lot, but an unpopular geisha earning 1 ohana per hour has a grim life. Probably she spends most evenings sitting around the charcoal brazier waiting for an engagement. Even when she's busy, she may earn no more than 10 yen a night, which won't be enough even to pay back her debts. Considering all the wealth that flows into Gion, she's nothing more than an insect picking at the carcass, compared with Hatsumomo or Mameha, who are magnificent lionesses feasting at the kill, not only because they have engagements all night long every night, but because they charge a good deal more as well. In Hatsumomo's case, she charged 1 ohana every 15 minutes, rather than 1 every hour. And in the case of Mameha, well, there was no one else in Gion quite like her. She charged 1 ohana every 5 minutes. Of course, no geisha keeps all her earnings, not even Mameha. The tea house where she earned the fees takes a portion, then a much smaller portion goes to the Geisha Association, and a portion to her dresser, and right on down the line, including a fee she might pay to an okia in exchange for keeping her account books and tracking her engagements. She probably keeps only a little more than half of what she earns. Still, it's an enormous sum when compared with the livelihood of an unpopular geisha who every day sinks deeper and deeper into a pit. Here's how a geisha like Hatsumomo could make her younger sister seem more successful than she really was. To begin with, a popular geisha in Gion is welcome at nearly any party and will drop in on many of them for only 5 minutes. Her customers will be happy to pay the fees, even though she's only saying hello. They know that the next time they visit Gion, she'll probably join them at the table for a while to give them the pleasure of her company. An apprentice, on the other hand, can't possibly get away with such behavior. Her role is to build relationships. Until she becomes a full-fledged geisha at the age of 18, She doesn't consider flitting from party to party. Instead, she stays for an hour or more, and only then telephones her Okia to ask her older sister's whereabouts, so she can go to another tea house and be introduced to a new round of guests. While her popular older sister might drop in on as many as 20 parties during an evening, an apprentice probably attends no more than 5. But this isn't what Hatsumomo was doing. She was taking Pumpkin with her everywhere she went. Until the age of 16, an apprentice geisha bills 1/2 ohana per hour. If Pumpkin stayed at a party only 5 minutes, the host was billed the same as if she'd stayed a full hour. On the other hand, no one expected Pumpkin to stay only 5 minutes. Probably the men didn't mind that Hatsumomo brought her younger sister for only a brief visit one night or even two. But after a while, they must have begun to wonder why she was too busy to stay longer and why her younger sister didn't remain behind, as she was expected to do. Pumpkin's earnings may have been high, you see, perhaps as high as 3 or 4 ohana every hour, but she was certain to pay for it with her reputation, and so was Hatsumomo. Hatsumomo's behavior only shows us how desperate she is, Ameha concluded. She'll do anything to make Pumpkin look good. And you know why, don't you?
I'm not sure, Mameha-san.
She wants Pumpkin to look good, so Mrs. Nitta will adopt her. If Pumpkin is made the daughter of the Okia, her future is assured, and so is Hatsumomo's. After all, Hatsumomo is Pumpkin's sister. Mrs. Nitta certainly wouldn't throw her out. Do you understand what I'm saying? If Pumpkin is adopted, you'll never be free of Hatsumomo, unless it is you who is thrown out. I felt as the waves of the ocean must feel when clouds have blocked the warmth of the sun. I'd hoped to see you as a popular young apprentice before long, Ameha went on, but Hatsumomo certainly has gotten in our way.
Yes, she has.
Well, at least you're learning how to entertain men properly. You're lucky to have met the Baron. I may not have found a way around Hatsumomo just yet, but to tell the truth... And here she stopped herself.
Ma'am, I said.
Oh, never mind, Sayuri. I'd be a fool to share my thoughts with you. I was hurt to hear this. Mameha must have noticed my feelings at once, for she was quick to say, You're living under the same roof as Hatsumomo, aren't you? Anything I say to you could get back to her.
I'm very sorry, Mameha-san, for whatever I've done to deserve your low opinion of me, I told her. Can you really imagine I'll run back to the Okia and tell anything to Hatsumomo?
I'm not worried about what you'll do. Mice don't get eaten because they run over to where the cat is sleeping and wake it up. You know perfectly well how resourceful Hatsumomo is. You'll just have to trust me, Sayuri.
Yes, ma'am, I replied,
for really there was nothing else I could say.
I will tell you one thing, Mameha said, leaning forward a bit, from what I took as excitement. You and I will be going to an engagement together in the next 2 weeks at a place Hatsumomo will never find us.
May I ask where?
Certainly not. I won't even tell you when. Just be prepared. You'll find out everything you need to know when the proper time comes.
When I returned to the Okia that afternoon, I hid myself upstairs to look through my almanac. A variety of days in the next 2 weeks stood out. One was the coming Wednesday, which was a favorable day for traveling westward. I thought perhaps Mameha planned to take me out of the city. Another was the following Monday, which also happened to be Tai'an, the most auspicious day of the 6-day Buddhist week. Finally, the Sunday after had a curious reading. A balance of good and bad can open the door to destiny. This one sounded most intriguing of all. I heard nothing from Ameha on Wednesday. A few afternoons later, she did summon me to her apartment, on a day my almanac said was unfavorable, but only to discuss a change in my tea ceremony class at the school. After this, an entire week had passed without a word from her. And then, on Sunday, around noon, I heard the door of the Okia roll open and put my shamisen down onto the walkway, where I'd been practicing for an hour or so, to rush to the front. I expected to see one of Mameha's maids, but it was only a man from the druggist's making a delivery of Chinese herbs for auntie's arthritis.
After one of our elderly maids took the packet, I was about to return to my chamacin when I noticed the delivery man trying to get my attention. He was holding a piece of paper in one hand so that only I could see it. Our maid was about to roll the door shut, but he said to me, "I'm sorry to trouble you, miss, but would you mind throwing this away for me?" The maid thought it odd, but I took the paper and pretended to throw it away in the maid's room. It was a note, unsigned, in Mameha's hand. "Ask Auntie permission to leave. Tell her I have work for you to do in my apartment, and come here no later than 1 o'clock. Don't let anyone else know where you're going." I'm sure Mameha's precautions were very sensible, but in any case, Mother was lunching with a friend, and Hatsumomo and Pumpkin had gone to an afternoon engagement already. No one remained in the Okya but Auntie and the maids. I went straight up to Auntie's room to find her draping a heavy cotton blanket across her futon, preparing for a nap. She stood shivering in her sleeping robe while I spoke to her. The moment she heard that Mameha had summoned me, she didn't even care to know the reason. She just gave a wave of her hand and crawled beneath the blanket to go to sleep. Mameha was still attending a morning engagement when I arrived at her apartment, but her maid showed me into the dressing room to help me with my makeup, and afterward brought in the kimono ensemble Mameha had set out for me. I'd grown accustomed to wearing Mameha's kimono, but in fact it's unusual for a geisha to lend out robes from her collection this way. Two friends in Gion might trade kimono for a night or two, but it's rare for an older geisha to show such kindness to a young girl, and in fact Mameha was going to a great deal of trouble on my behalf. She no longer wore these long-sleeved robes herself and had to retrieve them from storage. I often wondered if she expected to be repaid somehow. The kimono she'd laid out for me that day was the loveliest yet, an orange silk with a silver waterfall pouring from the knee into a slate-blue ocean. The waterfall was split by brown cliffs with knotted driftwood at the base, embroidered in lacquered threads. I didn't realize it, but the robe was well known in Gion. People who saw it probably thought of Mameha at once. In permitting me to wear it, I think she was rubbing some of her aura off onto me. After Mr. Ichoda had tied the obi, a russet and brown highlighted with gold threads, I put the final touches on my makeup and the ornaments in my hair. I tucked the chairman's handkerchief, which I'd brought from the Okia, as I often did, inside my obi, and stood before the mirror, gaping at myself. Already it was amazing to me that Mameha had arranged for me to look so beautiful, but to top it off, when she returned to her apartment, she herself changed into a fairly plain kimono. It was a robe the color of a mountain potato, covered with soft gray hatch marks, and her obi was a simple pattern of black diamonds on a background of deep blue. She had the understated brilliance of a pearl, as she always did, but when we walked down the street together, the women who bowed at Mameha were looking at me. From the Gion Shrine, we rode north in a rickshaw for a half hour into a section of Kyoto I'd never seen. Along the way, Mameha told me we would be attending a sumo exhibition as the guests of Iwamura Ken, the founder of Iwamura Electric in Osaka, which, incidentally, was the manufacturer of the heater that killed Granny. Iwamura's right-hand man, Nobu Toshikazu, who was the president of the company, would also be attending. Nobu was quite a fan of sumo and had helped organize the exhibition that afternoon. "I should tell you," she said to me, "that Nobu is a bit peculiar-looking. You'll make a great impression on him by behaving well when you meet him." After she said this, she gave me a look as if to say she would be terribly disappointed in me if I didn't. As for Hatsumomo, we wouldn't have to worry about her. Tickets to the exhibition had been sold out weeks before. At last we climbed out of the rickshaw at the campus of Kyoto University. Mameha led me up a dirt path lined with small pine trees. Western-style buildings closed in on both sides of us, the windows chopped into tiny glass squares by strips of painted wood. I hadn't realized how much Gion seemed like home to me until I noticed myself feeling out of place at the university. All around us were smooth-skinned young men with their hair parted some wearing suspenders to keep up their pants. They seemed to find Mameha and me so exotic that they stopped to watch as we strolled past and even made jokes to one another. Soon we passed through an iron gate with a crowd of older men and a number of women, including quite a few geisha. Kyoto had few places a sumo exhibition could be held indoors, and one was Kyoto University's old exhibition hall. The building no longer stands today, but at that time it fit with the Western structures around it, about like a shriveled old man in kimono fits with a group of businessmen. It was a big box of a building with a roof that didn't seem quite substantial enough, but made me think of a lid fitted onto the wrong pot. The huge doors on one side were so badly warped, they bulged against the iron rods fastened across them. Its ruggedness reminded me so much of my tipsy house that I felt sad for a moment. As I made my way up the stone steps into the building, I spotted two geisha strolling across the gravel courtyard and bowed to them. They nodded to me in return, and one said something to the other. I thought this very odd until I looked at them more closely. My heart sank. One of the women was Hatsumomo's friend, Corinne. I gave her another bow, now that I recognized her, and did my best to smile. The moment they looked away, I whispered to Mameha, "Mameha-san, I've just seen a friend of Hatsumomo's." I didn't know Hatsumomo had any friends. "It's Corinne. She's over there, or at least she was a moment ago, with another geisha." "I know, Corinne. Why are you so worried about her? What can she possibly do?" I didn't have an answer to this question, but if Mameha wasn't concerned, I could think of no reason why I ought to be. My first impression upon entering the exhibition hall was of an enormous empty space reaching up to the roof, beneath which sunlight poured in through screened windows high overhead. The huge expanse was filled with the noise of the crowd and with smoke from the sweet rice cakes roasted with miso paste on the grills outside. In the center was a square mound where the wrestlers would compete, dominated by a roof in the style of a Shinto shrine. A priest walked around on it, chanting blessings and shaking his sacred wand, adorned with folded paper strips. Mameha led me down to a tier in the front, where we removed our shoes and began to walk across in our split-toed socks on a little margin of wood. Our hosts were in this row, but I had no idea who they were until I caught sight of a man waving his hand to Mameha. I knew at once that he was Nobu. There was no doubt why Mameha had warned me about his appearance. Even from a distance, the skin of his face looked like a melted candle. At some time in his life, he had suffered terrible burns. His whole appearance was so tragic-looking, I couldn't imagine the agony he must have endured. Already, I was feeling strange from running into Corinne. Now I began to worry that when I met Nobu, I might make a fool of myself without quite understanding why. As I walked along behind Mameha, I focused my attention not on Nobu, but on a very elegant man seated beside him on the same tatami mat, wearing a pinstripe men's kimono. From the moment I set eyes on this man, I felt a strange stillness settling over me. He was talking with someone in another box, so that I could only see the back of his head. But he was so familiar to me that for a moment I could make no sense of what I saw. All I knew was that he was out of place there in the exhibition hall. Before I could even think why, I saw an image in my mind of him turning toward me on the streets of our little village. And then I realized it was Mr. Tanaka. He'd changed in some way I couldn't have described. I watched him reach up to smooth his gray hair and was struck by the graceful way he moved his fingers. Why did I find it so peculiarly soothing to look at him? Perhaps I was in a daze at seeing him and hardly knew how I really felt. Well, if I hated anyone in this world, I hated Mr. Tanaka. I had to remind myself of this. I wasn't going to kneel beside him and say, "Why, Mr. Tanaka, how very honored I am to see you again. What has brought you to Kyoto?" Instead, I would find some way of showing him my true feelings, even if it was hardly the proper thing for an apprentice to do. Actually, I'd thought of Mr. Tanaka very little these last few years, but still, I owed it to myself not to be kind to him, not to pour his sake into his cup if I could spill it on his leg instead. I would smile at him as I was obliged to smile, but it would be the smile I had so often seen on Hatsumomo's face, and then I would say, "Oh, Mr. Tanaka, the strong odor of fish. It makes me so homesick to sit here beside you." How shocked he would be. Or perhaps this, "Why, Mr. Tanaka, you look almost distinguished." Though in truth, as I looked at him, for by now we'd nearly reached the box in which he sat, he did look distinguished, more distinguished than I could ever have imagined. Mameha was just arriving, lowering herself to her knees to bow. Then he turned his head, and for the first time I saw his broad face and the sharpness of his cheekbones, and most of all, his eyelids folded so tightly in the corners and so smooth and flat. And suddenly everything around me seemed to grow quiet, as if he were the wind that blew and I were just a cloud carried upon it. He was familiar, certainly, more familiar in some ways than my own image in the mirror. But it wasn't Mr. Tanaka at all. It was the chairman. Chapter 17. I had seen the chairman during only one brief moment in my life, but I'd spent a great many moments since then imagining him. He was like a song I'd heard once in fragments but had been singing in my mind ever since. Though, of course, the notes had changed a bit over time, which is to say that I expected his forehead to be higher and his gray hair not so thick. When I saw him, I had a flicker of uncertainty whether he was really the chairman, but I felt so soothed, I knew without a doubt I had found him. While Mameha was greeting the two men, I stood behind, awaiting my turn to bow. What if my voice when I tried to speak should sound like a rag squeaking on polished wood? Nobu, with his tragic scars, was watching me, but I wasn't sure whether the chairman had even noticed me there. I was too timid to glance in his direction. When Mameha took her place and began to smooth her kimono over her knees, I saw that the chairman was looking at me with what I took to be curiosity. My feet actually went cold from all the blood that came rushing into my face. "Chairman Iwamura, President Nobu," Mameha said, "this is my new younger sister, Sayuri." I'm certain you've heard of the famous Iwamura Ken, founder of Iwamura Electric, and probably you've heard of Nobu Toshikazu as well. Certainly no business partnership in Japan was ever more famous than theirs. They were like a tree and its roots, or like a shrine and the gate that stands before it. Even as a 14-year-old girl, I'd heard of them, but I'd never imagined for a moment that Iwamura Ken might be the man I'd met on the banks of the Shirakawa stream. Well, I lowered myself to my knees and bowed to them, saying all the usual things about begging their indulgence and so forth. When I was done, I went to kneel in the space between them. Nobu fell into conversation with a man beside him, while the chairman, on the other side of me, sat with his hand around an empty teacup on a tray at his knee. Mameha began talking to him. I picked up a small teapot and held my sleeve out of the way to pour. To my astonishment, the chairman's eyes drifted to my arm. Of course, I was eager to see for myself exactly what he was seeing. Perhaps because of the murky light of the exhibition hall, the underside of my arm seemed to shine with the gleaming smoothness of a pearl and was a beautiful ivory color. No part of my body had ever struck me as lovely in this way before. I was very aware that the chairman's eyes weren't moving. As long as he kept looking at my arm, I certainly wasn't going to take it away. And then, suddenly, Mameha fell silent. It seemed to me she'd stopped talking because the chairman was watching my arm instead of listening to her. Then I realized what was really the matter. The teapot was empty. What was more, it had been empty even when I'd picked it up. I'd felt almost glamorous a moment earlier, but now I muttered an apology and put the pot down as quickly as I could. Mameha laughed. "You can see what a determined girl she is, Chairman," she said. "If there'd been a single drop of tea in that pot, Sayuri would have gotten it out." "That certainly is a beautiful kimono your younger sister is wearing, Mameha," the chairman said. Do I recall seeing it on you back during your days as an apprentice? If I felt any lingering doubts about whether this man was really the chairman, I felt them no longer after hearing the familiar kindness of his voice. It's possible, I suppose, Mameha replied. But the chairman has seen me in so many different kimono over the years, I can't imagine he remembers them all. Well, I'm no different from any other man. Beauty makes quite an impression on me. When it comes to these sumo wrestlers, I can't tell one of them from the next. Mameha leaned across in front of the chairman and whispered to me, What the chairman is really saying is that he doesn't particularly like sumo. Now, Mameha, he said, if you're trying to get me into trouble with Nobu... Chairman, Nobu-san has known for years how you feel. Nevertheless, Sayuri, is this your first encounter with sumo? I'd been waiting for some excuse to speak with him, but before I'd so much as taken a breath, we were all startled by a tremendous boom that shook the great building. Our heads turned and the crowd fell silent, but it was nothing more than the closing of one of the giant doors. In a moment, we could hear hinges creaking and saw the second door straining its way around in an arc, pushed by two of the wrestlers. Nobu had his head turned away from me. I couldn't resist peering at the terrible burns on the side of his face and his neck, and at his ear, which was misshapen. Then I saw that the sleeve of his jacket was empty. I'd been so preoccupied I hadn't noticed it earlier. It was folded in two and fastened to his shoulder by a long silver pin. I may as well tell you, if you don't know it already, that as a young lieutenant in the Japanese Marines, Nobu had been severely injured in a bombing outside Seoul in 1910. At the time, Korea was being annexed to Japan. I knew nothing about his heroism when I met him, though in fact the story was familiar all over Japan. If he'd never joined up with the chairman and eventually become president of Iwamura Electric, probably he would have been forgotten as a war hero, but as it was, his terrible injuries made the story of his success that much more remarkable. So the two were often mentioned together. I don't know too much about history, for they taught us only arts at the little school, but I think the Japanese government gained control over Korea at the end of the Russo-Japanese War, and a few years afterward made the decision to incorporate Korea into the growing empire. I'm sure the Koreans didn't much like this. Nobu went there as a part of a small force to keep things under control. Late one afternoon, he accompanied his commanding officer on a visit to a village near Seoul. On the way back to the spot where their horses were tied up, the members of the patrol came under attack. When they heard the horrible shrieking noise of an incoming shell, the commanding officer tried to climb down into a ditch, but he was an old man and moved at about the speed of a barnacle inching its way down a rock. Moments before the shell struck, he was still trying to find a foothold. Nobu laid himself over the commanding officer in an effort to save him, but the old man took this badly and tried to climb out. With some effort, he raised his head. Nobu tried to push it back down, but the shell struck, killing the commanding officer and injuring Nobu severely. In surgery, later that year, Nobu lost his left arm above the elbow. The first time I saw his pinned sleeve, I couldn't help averting my eyes in alarm. I'd never before seen anyone who'd lost a limb, though when I was a little girl, an assistant of Mr. Tanaka's had lost the tip of his finger one morning while cleaning a fish. In Nobu's case, many people felt his arm to be the least of his problems, because his skin was like an enormous wound. It's hard to describe the way he looked, and probably it would be cruel of me even to try. I'll just repeat what I overheard another geisha say about him once. Every time I look at his face, I think of a sweet potato that has blistered in the fire. When the huge doors were closed, I turned back to the chairman to answer his question. As an apprentice, I was free to sit as quietly as an arrangement of flowers, if I wanted to, but I was determined not to let this opportunity pass. Even if I made only the slightest impression on him, like a child's foot might make on a dusty floor, at least it would be a start. "The chairman asked if this is my first encounter with sumo," I said. "It is,
and I would be very grateful for anything the chairman might be kind enough to explain to me.
If you want to know what's going on, said Nobu, you'd better talk to me. What is your name, apprentice? I couldn't hear well with the noise of the crowd.
I turned away from the chairman with as much difficulty as a hungry child turns away from a plate of food. My name is Sayuri, sir, I said.
You're Mameha's younger sister. Why aren't you Mame something or other? Nobu went on. Isn't that one of your foolish traditions?
Yes, sir, but all the names with Mame turned out to be inauspicious for me, according to the fortune teller.
The fortune teller, Nobu said with contempt. Is he the one who picked your name for you?
I'm the one who picked it, Mameha said. The fortune teller doesn't pick names. He only tells us if they're acceptable.
One day, Mameha, Nobu replied, you'll grow up and stop listening to fools. Now, Nobu-san, said the chairman. Anyone hearing you talk would think you're the most modern man in the nation, yet I've never known anyone who believes more strongly in destiny than you do. Every man has his destiny, but who needs to go to a fortune teller to find it? Do I go to a chef to find out if I'm hungry? Nobu said. Anyway, Sayuri is a very pretty name, though pretty names and pretty girls don't always go together.
I was beginning to wonder if his next comment would be something like, what an ugly younger sister you've taken on, Mameha, or some such thing, but to my relief he said,
here's a case where the name and the girl go together. I believe she may be even prettier than you, Mameha.
Nobu-san, no woman likes to hear that she isn't the prettiest creature around.
Especially you, eh? Well, you'd better get used to it. She has especially beautiful eyes. Turn toward me, Sayuri, so I can have another look at them.
I couldn't very well look down at the mats, since Nobu wanted to see my eyes, nor could I stare directly back at him without seeming too forward. So, after my gaze slipped around a little, like trying to find a footing on ice, I finally let it settle in the region of his chin. If I could have willed my eyes to stop seeing, I would certainly have done it, because Nobu's features looked like poorly sculpted clay. You must remember that I knew nothing as yet about the tragedy that had disfigured him. When I wondered what had happened to him, I couldn't stop that terrible feeling of heaviness.
Your eyes certainly do shimmer in a most startling way, he said.
At that moment, a small door opened along the outside of the hall, and a man entered wearing an exceptionally formal kimono with a high black cap on his head, looking as if he'd stepped directly out of a painting of the imperial court. He made his way down the aisle, leading a procession of wrestlers so huge they had to crouch to pass through the doorway.
What do you know about sumo, young girl? Nobu asked me.
Only that the wrestlers are as big as whales, sir, I said. There's a man working in Gion who was once a sumo wrestler.
You must mean Owajumi. He's sitting just over there, you know.
With his one hand, Nobu pointed toward another tier where Owajumi sat, laughing about something, with Karin next to him. She must have spotted me, for she gave a little smile and then leaned in to say something to Owajumi, who looked in our direction.
He was never much of a wrestler, Nobu said. He liked to slam his opponents with his shoulder. It never worked, stupid man, but it broke his collarbone plenty of times.
By now, the wrestlers had all entered the building and stood around the base of the mound. One by one their names were announced, and they climbed up and arranged themselves in a circle facing the audience. Later, as they made their way out of the hall again so the wrestlers of the opposing side could begin their procession, Nobu said to me,
"That rope in a circle on the ground marks the ring. The first wrestler to be shoved outside it, or to touch the mound with anything but his feet, is the loser. It may sound easy, but how would you like to try pushing one of those giants over that rope?"
"I suppose I could come up behind him with wooden clappers," I said, and hope to scare him so badly he'd jump out.
Be serious, Nobu said.
I won't pretend this was a particularly clever thing for me to have said, but it was one of my first efforts at joking with a man. I felt so embarrassed I couldn't think what to say. Then the chairman leaned toward me.
"Nobu-san doesn't joke about sumo," he said quietly.
"I don't make jokes about the three things that matter most in life," Nobu said. "Sumo, business, and war."
"My goodness, I think that was a sort of joke," Mameha said. "Does that mean you're contradicting yourself?"
"If you were watching a battle," Nobu said to me, "or for that matter, sitting in the midst of a business meeting, would you understand what was happening?"
I wasn't sure what he meant, but I could tell from his tone that he expected me to say no.
"Oh, not at all," I answered. "Exactly. And you can't expect to understand what's going on in sumo, either. So you can laugh at Mameha's little jokes, or you can listen to me and learn what it all means."
"He's tried to teach me about it over the years," the chairman said quietly to me, "but I'm a very poor student."
"The chairman is a brilliant man," Nobu said. "He's a poor student of sumo because he doesn't care about it. He wouldn't be even here this afternoon except that he was generous enough to accept my proposal that Iwamura Electric be a sponsor of the exhibition."
By now, both teams had finished their ring-entering ceremonies. Two more special ceremonies followed, one for each of the two yokozuna. A yokozuna is the very highest rank in sumo, just like Mameha's position in Gion, as Nobu explained it to me. I had no reason to doubt him, but if Mameha ever took half as much time entering a party as these yokozuna took entering the ring, she'd certainly never be invited back. The second of the two was short and had a most remarkable face, not at all flabby but chiseled like stone, and with a jaw that made me think of the squared front end of a fishing boat. The audience cheered him so loudly I covered my ears. His name was Miyagiyama, and if you know sumo at all, you'll understand why they cheered as they did.
"He is the greatest wrestler I have ever seen," Nobu told me.
Just before the bouts were ready to begin, the announcer listed the winners' prizes. One was a considerable sum of cash offered by Nobu Toshikazu, president of the Iwamura Electric Company. Nobu seemed very annoyed when he heard this and said,
"What a fool! The money isn't from me. It's from Iwamura Electric. I apologize, Chairman. I'll call someone over to have the announcer correct his mistake."
"There's no mistake, Nobu. Considering the great debt I owe you, it's the least I can do."
"The chairman is too generous," Nobu said. "I'm very grateful."
And with this, he passed a sake cup to the chairman and filled it, and the two of them drank together. When the first wrestlers entered the ring, I expected the bout to begin right away. Instead, they spent 5 minutes or more tossing salt on the mound and squatting in order to tip their bodies to one side and raise a leg high in the air before slamming it down. From time to time, they crouched, glowering into each other's eyes, but just when I thought they were going to charge, one would stand and stroll away to scoop up another handful of salt. Finally, when I wasn't expecting it, it happened. They slammed into each other, grabbing at loincloths, but within an instant, one had shoved the other off balance and the match was over. The audience clapped and shouted, but Nobu just shook his head and said, "Poor technique." During the bouts that followed, I often felt that one ear was linked to my mind and the other to my heart, because on one side I listened to what Nobu told me, and much of it was interesting, but the sound of the chairman's voice on the other side as he went on talking with Mameha always distracted me. An hour or more passed, and then the movement of a brilliant color in Owajiumi's section caught my eye. It was an orange silk flower swaying in a woman's hair as she took her place on her knees. At first I thought it was Corinne and that she had changed her kimono, but then I saw it wasn't Corinne at all. It was Hatsumomo. To see her there when I hadn't expected her, I felt a jolt as if I'd stepped on an electric wire. Surely it was only a matter of time before she found a way of humiliating me, even here in this giant hall amid hundreds of people. I didn't mind her making a fool of me in front of a crowd if it had to happen,
but I couldn't bear the thought of looking like a fool in front of the chairman. I felt such a hotness in my throat I could hardly even pretend to listen when Nobu began telling me something about the two wrestlers climbing onto the mound. When I looked at Mameha, she flicked her eyes toward Hatsumomo and then said, "Chairman, forgive me. I have to excuse myself. It occurs to me Sayuri may want to do the same." She waited until Nobu was done with his story, and then I followed her out of the hall.
"Oh, Mameha-san, she's like a demon," I said.
"Corinne left more than an hour ago. She must have found Hatsumomo and sent her here. You ought to feel flattered, really, considering that Hatsumomo goes to so much trouble to torment you."
"I can't bear to have her make a fool of me in front of... well, in front of all these people."
"But if you do something she finds laughable, she'll leave you alone, don't you think?"
"Please, Mameha-san, don't make me embarrass myself."
We crossed a courtyard and were just about to climb the steps into the building where the toilets were housed, but Mameha led me some distance down a covered passageway instead. When we were out of earshot of anyone, she spoke quietly to me. "Nobu-san and the chairman have been great patrons of mine over the years. Heaven knows Nobu can be harsh with people he doesn't like, but he's as loyal to his friends as a retainer is to a feudal lord, and you'll never meet a more trustworthy man. Do you think Hatsumomo understands these qualities? All she sees when she looks at Nobu is Mr. Lizard, that's what she calls him."
"Mameha-san, I saw you with Mr. Lizard last night. Oh goodness, you look all splotchy. I think he's rubbing off on you. That sort of thing. Now, I don't care what you think of Nobu-san at the moment. In time you'll come to see what a good man he is, but Hatsumomo may very well leave you alone if she thinks you've taken a strong liking to him." I couldn't think how to respond to this. I wasn't even sure just yet what Mameha was asking me to do.
"Nobu-san has been talking to you about sumo for much of the afternoon," she went on. "For all anyone knows, you adore him. Now put on a show for Hatsumomo's benefit. Let her think you're more charmed with him than you've ever been by anyone. She'll think it's the funniest thing she's ever seen. Probably she'll want you to stay on in Gion just so she can see more of it."
"But, Mameha-san, how am I going to make Hatsumomo think I'm fascinated by him?"
"If you can't manage such a thing, I haven't trained you properly," she replied. When we returned to our box, Nobu had once again fallen into conversation with a man nearby. I couldn't interrupt, so I pretended to be absorbed in watching the wrestlers on the mound prepare for their bout. The audience had grown restless. Nobu wasn't the only one talking. I felt such a longing to turn to the chairman and ask if he recalled a day several years ago when he'd shown kindness to a young girl, but of course I could never say such a thing. Besides, it would be disastrous for me to focus my attention on him while Hatsumomo was watching. Soon, Nobu turned back to me and said, "These bouts have been tedious. When Miyagiyama comes out, we'll see some real skill." This, it seemed to me, was my chance to dote on him.
"But the wrestling I've seen already has been so impressive," I said, "and the things President Nobu has been kind enough to tell me have been so interesting I can hardly imagine we haven't seen the best already."
"Don't be ridiculous," said Nobu. "None of these wrestlers deserves to be in the same ring as Miyagiyama."
Over Nobu's shoulder, I could see Hatsumomo in a far tier. She was chatting with Owajiyumi and didn't appear to be looking at me.
"I know this may seem a very foolish thing to ask," I said, "but how can a wrestler as small as Miyagiyama be the greatest?"
And if you had seen my face, you might have thought no subject had ever interested me more. I felt ridiculous, pretending to be absorbed by something so trivial, but no one who saw us would have known that we weren't talking about the deepest secrets of our souls. I'm happy to say that at that very moment I caught a glimpse of Hatsumomo turning her head toward me.
"Miyagiyama only looks small because the others are so much fatter," Nobu was saying. "But he's very vain about his size. His height and weight were printed in the newspaper perfectly correctly a few years ago, and yet he was so offended he had a friend hit him on top of the head with a plank and then gorged himself on sweet potatoes and water, and went down to the newspaper to show them they were wrong." Probably I would have laughed at nearly anything Nobu had said, for Hatsumomo's benefit, I mean, but in fact it really was quite funny to imagine Miyagiyama squinting his eyes shut and waiting for the plank to come banging down.
I held that image in my mind and laughed as freely as I dared, and soon Nobu began to laugh with me. We must have looked like the best of friends to Hatsumomo, for I saw her clapping her hands in delight. Soon I struck upon the idea of pretending that Nobu himself was the chairman. Every time he spoke, I overlooked his gruffness and tried to imagine gentleness instead. Gradually, I found myself able to look at his lips and block from my mind the discoloring and the scars, and imagine that they were the chairman's lips, and that every nuance in his voice was some comment on his feelings about me. At one point, I think I convinced myself I wasn't even in the exhibition hall, but in a quiet room kneeling beside the chairman. I hadn't felt such bliss in as long a time as I could remember, like a ball tossed in the air that seems to hang motionless before it falls. I felt myself suspended in a state of quiet timelessness. As I glanced around the hall, I saw only the beauty of its giant wooden timbers and smelled the aroma of the sweet rice cakes. I thought this state might never end, but then, at some point, I made a comment I don't even remember, and Nobu responded, "What are you talking about? Only a fool could think such an ignorant thing." My smile fell before I could stop it, just as if the strings holding it had been cut. Nobu was looking me square in the eye. Of course, Hatsumomo sat far away, but I felt certain she was watching us. And then it occurred to me that if a geisha or a young apprentice grew teary-eyed in front of a man, wouldn't most anyone take it for infatuation? I might have responded to his harsh comment with an apology. Instead, I tried to imagine it was the chairman who had spoken to me so abruptly, and in a moment my lip was trembling. I lowered my head and made a great show of being childish. To my surprise, Nobu said, "I've hurt you, haven't I?" It wasn't difficult for me to sniff theatrically. Nobu went on looking at me for a long moment and then said, "You're a charming girl." I'm sure he intended to say something further, but at that moment Miyagiyama came into the hall and the crowd began to roar. For a long while, Miyagiyama and the other wrestler, whose name was Saiho, swaggered around the mound, scooping up salt and tossing it into the ring, or stamping their feet as sumo wrestlers do. Every time they crouched, facing each other, they made me think of two boulders on the point of tipping over. Miyagiyama always seemed to lean forward a bit more than Saiho, who was taller and much heavier. I thought when they slammed into each other, poor Miyagiyama would certainly be driven back. I couldn't imagine anyone dragging Saiho across that ring. They took up their position 8 or 9 times without either of the men charging. Then Nobu whispered to me, "Hataki komi. He's going to use hataki komi. Just watch his eyes." I did what Nobu suggested, but all I noticed was that Miyagiyama never looked at Saiho. I don't think Saiho liked being ignored in this way, because he glowered at his opponent as ferociously as an animal. His jowls were so enormous that his head was shaped like a mountain, and from anger his face had begun to turn red. But Miyagiyama continued to act as though he scarcely noticed him. "It won't last much longer," Nobu whispered to me. And in fact, the next time they crouched on their fists, Saiho charged. To see Miyagiyama leaning forward as he did, you'd have thought he was ready to throw his weight into Saiho, but instead, he used the force of Saiho's charge to stand back up on his feet. In an instant, he swiveled out of the way like a swinging door, and his hand came down onto the back of Saiho's neck. By now, Saiho's weight was so far forward he looked like someone falling down the stairs. Miyagiyama gave him a push with all his force, and Saiho brushed right over the rope at his feet. Then, to my astonishment, this mountain of a man flew past the lip of the mound and came sprawling right into the first row of the audience. The spectators tried to scamper out of the way, but when it was over, one man stood up gasping for air because one of Saiho's shoulders had crushed him. The encounter had scarcely lasted a second. Saiho must have felt humiliated by his defeat because he gave the most abbreviated bow of all the losers that day and walked out of the hall while the crowd was still in an uproar. "That," Nobu said to me, "is the move called hitake komi." "Isn't it fascinating?" Mameha said, in something of a daze. She didn't even finish her thought.
"Isn't what fascinating?" the chairman asked her.
"What Miyagiyama just did. I've never seen anything like it."
"Yes, you have. Wrestlers do that sort of thing all the time."
"Well, it certainly has got me thinking,"
Mameha said. Later on our way back to Gion, Mameha turned to me excitedly in the rickshaw. "That sumo wrestler gave me a most marvelous idea," she said. "Hatsumomo doesn't even know it, but she's just been thrown off balance herself, and she won't even find it out until it's too late."
"You have a plan? Oh, Mameha-san, please tell it to me."
"Do you think for a moment I would?" she said. "I'm not even going to tell it to my own maid. Just be very sure to keep Nobu-san interested in you. Everything depends on him and on one other man as well."
"What other man?"
"A man you haven't met yet. Now don't talk about it any further. I've probably said more than I should already. It's a great thing you met Nobu-san today. He may just prove to be your rescuer." I must admit I felt a sickness inside when I heard this. If I was to have a rescuer, I wanted it to be the chairman and no one else. Chapter 18. Now that I knew the identity of the chairman, I began that very night to read every discarded news magazine I could find in the hopes of learning more about him. Within a week, I'd accumulated such a stack of them in my room that Auntie gave me a look as if I'd lost my mind. I did find mention of him in a number of articles, but only in passing, and none told me the sorts of things I really wanted to know. Still, I went on picking up every magazine I found poking out of a trash basket, until one day I came upon a stack of old papers tied in a bundle behind one of the tea houses. Buried in it was a 2-year-old issue of a news magazine that happened to feature an article on Iwamura Electric. It seemed that Iwamura Electric had celebrated its 20th anniversary in April of 1931. It astonishes me even now to think of it, but this was the same month when I met the chairman on the banks of the Shirakawa Stream. I would have seen his face in all the magazines if only I'd looked in them. Now that I knew a date to search for, I managed over the course of time to find many more articles about the anniversary. Most of them came from a collection of junk thrown out after the death of an old granny who lived in an okia across the alley. The chairman had been born in 1890, as I learned, which meant that despite his gray hair, he'd been a little over 40 when I met him. I'd formed the impression that day he was probably chairman of an unimportant company, but I was quite wrong. Iwamura Electric wasn't as big as Osaka Electric, its chief rival in western Japan, according to all the articles, but the chairman and Nobu, because of their celebrated partnership, were much better known than the chiefs of much larger companies. In any case, Iwamura Electric was considered more innovative and had a better reputation. At 17, the chairman had gone to work at a small electric company in Osaka. Soon he was supervising the crew that installed wiring for machinery at factories in the area. The demand for electric lighting in households and offices was growing at this time, and during the evenings the chairman designed a fixture to allow the use of 2 light bulbs in a socket built for only one. The director of the company wouldn't build it, however, so at the age of 22 in 1912, shortly after marrying, the chairman left to establish his own company. For a few years, things were difficult. Then in 1914, the chairman's new company won the electrical wiring contract for a new building on a military base in Osaka. Nobu was still in the military at this time, since his war wounds made it difficult for him to find a job anywhere else. He was given the task of overseeing the work done by the new Iwamura Electric Company. He and the chairman quickly became friends, and when the chairman offered him a job the following year, Nobu took it. The more I read about their partnership, the more I understood just how well-suited they really were to each other. Nearly all the articles showed the same photograph of them, with the chairman in a stylish 3-piece suit of heavy wool holding in his hand the ceramic 2-bulb socket that had been the company's first product. He looked as if someone had just handed it to him, and he hadn't yet decided what he was going to do with it. His mouth was slightly open, showing his teeth, and he stared at the camera with an almost menacing look, as though he were about to throw the fixture. By contrast, Nobu stood beside him, half a head shorter and at full attention, with his one hand in a fist at his side. He wore a morning coat and pinstriped trousers. His scarred face was completely without expression, and his eyes looked sleepy. The chairman, perhaps because of his prematurely gray hair and the difference in their sizes, might almost have been Nobu's father, though he was only 2 years older.
The article said that while the chairman was responsible for the company's growth and direction, Nobu was responsible for managing it. He was the less glamorous man with the less glamorous job, but apparently he did it so well that the chairman often said publicly that the company would never have survived several crises without Nobu's talents.